Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
And Leo has a bit of a cold, so he's been coughing quite a bit. He picked up my cold, and I really do feel sorry for him, so he might be resting his voice just a little bit.
However, she does feel better, and I don't. So we are going to hobble along tonight. I've got an interview. We got an interview with,
Which one was that?
I just had the book over here somewhere. Ten ways to survive when your world falls apart or something.
Oh, 10 things that you need to do to make your world better.
Yeah.
And
it's on the floor there, I think, next to you.
Leo did have the book here. I think he's misplaced it.
Check it out.
But it'll say exactly in the interview. We did it a couple of weeks ago. It'll say exactly in the interview who the author is and what the exact title is.
Yeah.
But she was really great, and she tells you 10 things that you can focus on.
To make
your life better.
That's terrible. I should have it here, but I don't. And but we are going to have the interview with her, and we'll post that in afterwards. This is so terribly inefficient here, this system I have. And if you saw the studio spot, my working studio, you would be amazed at the...
The reason it's the way it is he doesn't take care of it.
Well, I have 500 videos here and, about as many books and...
No, it would help if he doesn't pick anything up. That's why he can't find it.
Yeah, so
but anyway,
let me
read this from prisonplanet.com. Obama czar wants mandatory government propaganda on political websites. How about this? This is by Paul Joseph Watson. Disturbing audio has emerged of White House information czar Cass Sunstein, who in a previous white paper calling for banning conspiracy theories, demanding that websites be mandated by law to link to opposing information or that pop-ups containing government propaganda be forcibly included on political blogs. In an audio excerpt of an interview which was posted on Breitbart TV website today, Sunstein discusses how conservative websites should provide links to liberal websites and vice versa, or even how political blogs should be made to include pop-ups that show a quick argument for a competing view. Sunstein said that if this system couldn't be implemented voluntarily, Congress should hold hearings about mandates, which would legally force people to dilute their own free speech. I don't like this at all. The Harvard professor, boy, they have some idiots out of Harvard, also said that blogs should be forced to list a random draw of 25 popular websites such as CNN.com. I don't think so. The best would be for this to be done voluntarily, Sunstein said, but the word voluntarily is a little complicated in people sometimes don't do what's best for our society, he added. The idea would be to have a legal mandate as the last resort, an ultimate weapon designed to encourage people to do better, Sunstein concluded. As we previously reported, this is PrisonPlanet.com speaking, in a January 2008 white paper entitled Conspiracy Theories, the Harvard professor, who is currently President Obama's head of information technology in the White House, called for conspiracy theories, that is, any political opinion which didn't concur with the establishment view, to be taxed or even banned outright. What is this guy, a Nazi? In a set of proposals designed to counter dangerous ideas, Sunstein suggested that the government could ban conspiracy theorizing or impose some kind of tax, financial or otherwise, on those who disseminate such theories. So-called conspiracy theories that Sunstein could be subject to government censorship include beliefs held by the vast majority of Americans, such as the notion that JFK assassination occurred as a part of a wider plot. In his white paper, Sunstein also cited the belief that global warming is a deliberate fraud as another marginal conspiracy theory to be countered by government censorship. Ludicrously, the Harvard professor even characterized as false and dangerous the idea that exposure to sunlight is healthy, despite the fact that top medical experts agree prolonged exposure to sunlight reduces the risk of developing certain cancers. Essentially, Sunstein wanted to be written into law that the government can dictate the very nature of reality to Americans, and that their opinions can only be voiced at best when accompanied by mandatory federal propaganda, or worse, that Americans can be silenced entirely by federal decree. This callous disregard for the First Amendment represents a fundamental threat, the very fabric of this country. And it's even more alarming considering the position of Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Elena Kagan, with regard to free speech. During the Citizens United versus the FEC case, Kagan's office argued that the government can ban books and political pamphlets. In separate writings, Kagan argued that the government could disappear free speech it deemed to be offensive. Oh, God, help us from these Harvard people.
Not frightening, isn't
it? Very frightening.
Yeah, and so.
And Obama's frightening. He appointed them.
Yeah, you know what always amazed me? What always amazed me is how these people.
How they get ahead.
No, just how they get ahead. How they. Why people don't bomb those kind of places. You know, they're always bombing, like, the people that gets messed up. You know, like the malls or the airports or whatever. You know, they target the average guy, right? But but it's so easy to see who the crooks and criminals and thieves are.
Well, they're all protected and insulated.
If you gotta go, do it right, dudes. I mean, don't do it wrong. You know, come on, good Lord. I'm not advocating anything. All I'm doing is just saying the truth. I mean, the worst criminal minds come out of these institutions, right? Men like Henry Kissinger, men like Zabrinsky, and men like Ashcroft, and all these other asswipes that of insidious.
I don't think Ashcroft.
Oh, I'm thinking all these attorney generals, people who've done sleazy things. Then you got the Yale team, you got people like that. But you got, I think Paulson was out of Yale or Harvard, Paulson, Hank Paulson, Treasury Secretary, the guy who fucked up the entire economy.
I don't know.
Bush was from Yale, and Harvard. I mean, he kissed both apples.
He was a double dipper.
Yeah, and then, his father was Yale, and all the CIA is from Yale. And it's like, come on, this is well known. You got, I write about this in my book, by the way. I mean, you want to get my book, folks? I swear to God, it's an eye opener. It's worth every cent that you spend. Now, if you don't happen to have the money, you can go and pick it up from iUniverse.com. It's $9.99. You can download the book. You know, it's a good book. And I'll tell you what, if you like it. Enough. What I'll do is I'll tell me that you bought it. Send it to L.A. Steel, P.O. Box 127, all right, Salisbury, Connecticut, all right, 06068. And what I'll do is I'll just send me a note just saying that you purchased it, and I'll be happy to sign an autograph note to you, all right, for buying it.
Autograph the book for them.
Well, I can't autograph the book. I mean, it's a download. You know what I mean?
It's an
e-book thing. You know what I mean? So if they want, just let me know. Or you can email me at asteelexclusive@gmail.com, and tell me about it, and I'll send something to you. But I appreciate it very much, and. I hope you buy the book.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, and you'll enjoy it because everything we talk about here and have for the last 500 shows on Blog Talk and another 500 shows on U103.
Here's a follow-up on Kagan argued.
It's all documented, folks. You know.
Here's a follow-up to what I just said in the last article. Kagan argued government could ban books. In an interview on NBC Meet the Press, Senator Mitch McConnell pointed out that Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Alina Kagan, once argued that the government should have the power to ban books and censor political pamphlets. And yet, more alarmingly, information on Kagan's hostility to the First Amendment just doesn't come to light. During the Citizen United versus FEC case, Kagan's office was asked by Chief Justice John Roberts if the government could ban publications if they were paid for by corporations or labor unions. If it's a 500-page book and at the end it says, and vote for X, the government could ban that, Roberts asked, to which Kagan Deputy Malcolm L. Stewart said the government could censor such information. Justice Roberts blasted Kagan's argument at the time. The government urges us in this case to uphold the direct prohibition on political speech. It asks us to embrace a theory of the First Amendment that would allow censorship not only of TV and radio, but of pamphlets, posters, and the Internet, and virtually any other medium that corporations and unions might find useful in expressing their views on the matters of public concern. Solicitor Kagan's office in the initial hearing argued that it would be okay to ban books. And then when there was a rehearing, Solicitor Kagan herself, in her first Supreme Court argument, she just recently had a Supreme Court argument, how could she be qualified for the court, suggested that it might be okay to ban pamphlets. McConnell called for a full investigation of Kagan's First Amendment stance in light of her troubling position on free speech, adding that the classic political pamphlets like Tom Paine's Common Sense and the Federalist Papers could be banned under Kagan's logic. Under Kagan's definition of the government's role in protecting free speech, the state would also have to remit to censor things like newspaper editorials, as well as public opinions of radio talk show hosts or television reporters. This is alarming, given the fact that Obama's information technology czar, Cass Sunstein, has called for the reduction of the fairness doctrine, which would also force political websites to carry mandatory government propaganda. Obama's Supreme Court nominee also thinks certain expressions of free speech should be disappeared if the government deems them offensive. On the surface, that's any opinion on racial, sexuality, or gender issues. But since criticizing Obama is now deemed racist, where will it end? In 1993, the University of Chicago Law Review article Kagan wrote, that I take it as a given that we live in a society marred by racial and gender inequality, that certain forms of speech perpetuate and promote the inequality, and that the uncoerced disappearance of such speech would be for cause for a great elation. In 1996 paper, Private Speech, Public Purpose, The Role of Government Motive in First Amendment Doctrine, Kagan argued it may be proper to suppress free speech because it is offensive to the society or to government. Kagan's standpoint in free speech that is the subject to regulation and definition by the government has no place in America, completely violates the fundamental premise of the First Amendment, and that even unpopular speech should be protected and will be better suited for countries like Iran, Zimbabwe, or North Korea. Little surprise, therefore, when we learn that in her undergraduate thesis at Princeton, Kagan lamented the decline of socialism. In the U.S., as sad for those who still hope to change America. If Kagan is approved, she's going to find an eager ally in the White House information czar, Cass Sunstein. Kagan's repulsive take on the rights enshrined in the Constitution is not just limited to free speech. The Supreme Court nominee outlined her belief that Americans can be guilty until proven innocent, or in fact just plain guilty without even the chance to be proven innocent, when she was quoted as saying that someone suspected of helping finance Al-Qaeda should be subject to the battlefield law, indefinite detention without trial, even if you were captured in a place like the Philippines rather than the battle zone. Kagan is also hostile to the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. She has habitually come down on the side of gun control and claiming that the state has the right to impose restrictive gun laws and said that she disagrees with the language of the Second Amendment. Despite accepting the 5-4 decision in the District of Columbia versus Heller as a precedent on gun rights, Kagan added that the Constitution provides strong, although not unlimited, protection against government regulation, thus leaving the door open for future regulation.
Remember that show we filmed right when?
Leo was getting our interview ready, I think.
Yeah, I got a special one too before we make the other.
Did you want to start or?
Yeah, hang on 1 second. While I'm setting this up, there's one more I think you should read, if you don't mind.
Okay.
It's I'll let you choose. I thought these were both important. I read this one last night, but this one here, all right, is important. That's really interesting. I thought this one might be really interesting. Financial terrorists want global currency, global central bank.
During a recent, this is by Paul Joseph Watson as well. He's got some very good articles. And this is from Prison Planet.
Yeah.
During a recent speech at a conference of elitists in Zurich, Switzerland, International Monetary Fund Chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn called for the introduction of a global currency backed by a global central bank, which would act as the lender of last resort. Can you imagine we'd be held prisoner? In the event of a severe economic crisis, which would present another lurch towards fascist centralization, represent another lurch forward towards fascist centralization of power by financial terrorists busy exploiting the financial chaos they created in order to impose world government. Stating that crisis is an opportunity, Strauss-Kahn said that globalists should exploit the financial chaos plaguing the world in order to push for new global currency issued by a global central bank. Strauss-Kahn said that the global currency would represent a risk-free asset for the system independent of national currencies, and thus a global central bank could also serve as a lender of last resort. The IMF chief is basically arguing for an expanded model of a system that is habitually used to swallow up and turn entire countries into slaves of the International Monetary Fund. Of course, the fact that the global economic governance has proven to be fraught with instability in the light of the euro crisis, with concerns about the single currency's survival spreading like a virus as a result of the Greece disaster, is irrelevant to globalists who are still trying to impose as their saviors with their solution of more centralization of power and more global governments, despite the fact that this is what caused the problem in the first place. That's right. But, you know, Europe can't act like the United States. There are too many borders, too many separate issues. It's not like it can be to have a central currency like the United States, because they're a country, it's a group of separate countries with separate borders, separate ways of life, different cultures. It's not like the United States. We're united under one culture, one idea. We have fluid borders. If you don't have a job in California, you can move to Maine and get one. It's not so easy to move from Switzerland to Spain, that sort of thing. Well, anyway, As we have previously highlighted, globalists are intent on exploiting the financial crises to set up a bank of the world that will be used to further centralize financial regulatory power and control over national economies for the administrative convenience of central bankers. In April of 2009, the Washington Post reported on plans to turn the IMF into a veritable United Nations for the global economies, giving it vastly expanded authority as a global banker to governments rich and poor. While there's no question about the agenda to implement a bank of the world, elitists are still infighting about precisely which institution will run the show. During a speech to the Council on Foreign Relations last month, European Central Bank head Jean-Claude Trichet called for the Bank for International Settlements to be used as the de facto global bank. As we highlighted, the BIS is notoriously corrupt institution that was founded and run by top Nazis in league with British and American industrialists during and after the Second World War. Power brokers who controlled the BIS included men such as Herman Schmitz, the director of the IG Farben, whose subsidiary company manufactured Zyklon B, the pesticide used in Nazi concentration camp gas chambers to kill Jews and political dissidents during the Holocaust. Another director of the bank was Walter Funk, who was appointed Nazi propaganda minister in 1933 before going on to become Hitler's Minister for Economic Affairs. Another BIS director during the period was Emil Puhl, who as director and vice president of Germany's Rush Bank was responsible for moving Nazi gold. Both Funk and Puhl were convicted at the Nuremberg trials as war criminals. Despite the fact that the BIS was also run by American and British industrialists and bankers, according to author Charles Higgins, the bank became a money funnel for American and British funds to flow into Hitler's coffers and to help Hitler build up his war machine. Today, the BIS is headed by the world's central bankers, people like Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke and Bank of England head Mervyn King, as well as Trichet himself. There is no doubt that the elite are pushing for a global central bank and a global currency. The only issue in their eyes is whether the bank will be controlled by the predatory IMF or the Nazi-founded corrupt BIS, which in either case would represent another dangerous lurch toward authoritarian world government run by financial terrorists who have feverishly set about exploiting the financial crisis that their policies created in order to lock in global economic fascism. So is our report ready?
I think so. I keep thinking it's ready, but it doesn't seem to be ready.
Well, you'll have to read something else. Voice is gone.
Right. I don't think this will be it.
So, we have hopefully gotten the interview ready.
Not quite.
So. Hopefully he will get this interview up and going. I don't have any voice to read anymore.
Okay. That ain't going to happen that way. There's so many things that just confuse us to play. Maybe it wasn't meant to play that way.
Well, play the other one from last night.
I'm very upset.
Leo has the second one from last night he can play. So play the one from last night.
Yeah.
So we
I'll
don't.
Play. This one will play.
Or if it doesn't, then it's the tape recorder.
Yeah.
Well, you have it at the end. That's why it's switching off.
Don't
it's already.
Tell me where I know.
That's what you've done. You've got it on the wall.
Man.
Well, hurry up and get it fixed.
Like a man. Oh, real fast, I'll tell you.
But I can't read anymore because my voice is gone.
That's all right. straighten this out.
So you're going to be the one on...
I was going to tell you who the author is, you know, and I hope we can get this interview up. Excuse me. I should have really canceled tonight's show, too, and not up to it. But the 10 things to do when your life falls apart and you have bronchitis and you are a talk show host. All by Daphne Rose, the King Ma, okay? An emotional and spiritual handbook. And,
it was very good.
Yeah, Lila liked it, you know, and
I think it's the kind of book that you want to read before you have a crisis, so then you kind of remember what to do, and then you read it again, and you say, oh, there was that book that helped me.
Yeah, you know, it might be something.
That might have some help in it.
Yeah, it's called Daphne Rose Kingma, K-I-N-G-M-A. The author.
And she was a very upbeat person. She was great.
I'm hoping and praying that this will come on. What the hell is going on with this?
You rewound it, now turn it around.
I did, but for some reason it's just not playing. Okay, that means that it's playing on that side. So it should be playing on some side.
Sounds like we always
have. We're having a terrible time here with this.
This tape recorder is broken.
Well, it's not that I can't find the interview on this. It's driving me into my really grave. So, anyway, and I had another one that I was going to play with you for you tonight. I had the same problem. So maybe my thing here. But we'll get around to it, I hope.
Well, hopefully we'll have one.
And if we do, we will play it. If we don't, we will hack on here. If you want to get through the crisis, you will have to. Okay. If you want to get through the crisis, you will have to. Cry your heart out. Okay. He who sits in the house of grief will eventually sit in the garden of peace. This is all stuff from this book, 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. And one of them is not shoot yourself, nor is another one shoot somebody else. Grief as Suicide Prevention. This is really upbeat stuff. The Golden Shawl. I found it. Lila liked it because it's really like a woman's book, you know.
No,
it reads like a woman's book. And
I don't think so.
Well, it's written by a woman, so it'd be normal to read like one, you know. But women have so much more. I can't remove this tape. I don't know why. Just what you want.
The machine.
Yeah, I think the machine went berserk.
Are you putting it in upside down?
No, since it's done, it's cooked. Unfortunately, we're not going to have our la-di-da thing tonight, our interview. Sorry, Lila. I will hobble along if you lose your voice here. I will go.
Well, I can't read too much anymore. My throat hurts.
Well, being a counselor to children, many whose lives are falling apart, or have fell apart, you're involved a great deal in help building them up again. You know, so a lot of these things that you that they advise, you use as
well. They're tools for when you know. It's sort of like when the old saying, when you have lemons, you make lemonade.
Yeah.
So not one of us can avoid tragedy or problems in our journey through life. You have to know how to make whatever happens to you, turn it into an opportunity and work with it.
It's like it says, imagine a future you can't imagine. That changing your consciousness and thus your experience of life begins with an act of courage. And no matter how scared you may be in the circumstances that are besetting you now, if you just take a leap into the unknown, whether it's a literal bungee jump across an abyss or saying some words you thought you could never utter, you will find that your reality starts changing. And what you did in the past is what brought you to where you are. And what you have the courage to do from now on is what you will bring you a new world to you. And you know, I agree with that in a big way, because I've had life changing events happen and still do.
We all do.
Oops. And
we have to recognize them. And
sometimes
when you look back, you recognize it as life changing. Maybe when it's happening, you don't.
Well, I think
because you don't see the path in front of you, really.
Yeah. Well, I knew like my first real life changing was when I had an industrial accident when I was like 17. And prior to that, I wanted to be a musician, you know. I played guitar. In fact, I played it quite well. And unfortunately, I took a job in a sawmill one summer when I was in high school. And that was the end of my music career, basically. And I cut my part of my hand off. But I had, but that changed my life. And it changed the reality that I was no longer going to be able to do what I did, you know, as a musician before, you know. And that bothered
me. Your dream.
Yeah, because I was really working hard to master something. But it made me realize that, and the only reason I took that horrible job was because my father was so insistent that I get this, that he got this job for me. Thanks, Dad. You know, so, but it was like, you know, you either do it or you know, because I was like 17. And, I was planning to have a different career. And anyway, worse came to worse, and the accident happened and the career ended and the image of it did. Anyway, I found myself going more toward art and writing and so on and so forth, as opposed to music, because I couldn't play the music any longer, and it bothered me, and I didn't really have the voice to go with it on a choral, vocal range. So it was annoying, and then you really didn't know what you wanted to do. And it changed my life. And then there are other life-changing events like deaths and so on and so forth that really, really make you spin. And each time there's certain things in this book that I saw that I said, yeah, you know, she's right on run the money with a lot of this. And one of them is persistence. You got to keep persisting. You got to keep moving. You got to keep getting out of your own way, you know. And it says your heart will lead the way. And that's pretty much true. Your heart does lead the way, because where you want to go, you already know. And if you just follow your heart and stop thinking about, you know, all the other fears that go with it, you'll get there.
Well, fear is a thing that dissuades people from doing what they really are born to do.
Are born to do, yeah.
Or they let other people influence them
as to what to do. And you know, it'd be totally and deadly wrong, but you have to have... Sometimes we have to stand up at a very young age, okay, and say, this is wrong. I don't want to do this. It's like anybody, for instance, joins the military at 17 years old, right? They get out of high school, and bam, they're in the military, you know. Or worse, they fail. They drop out of high school. And join the military, finish their high school education in the military. So it's like bad news all the way around. I mean, you have to start saying no to yourself, because what will happen is you'll get into the military and you'll find yourself killing people. You'll find yourself doing things that you're saying, why in the hell am I doing this?
Sometimes at 17 you don't ask that.
And you don't ask that stuff until you get there, and then you're
no, asking. You don't even ask it when you get there. You've
But how do you,
it's
you
later know, on that what you
No, it's then. I mean, people at 18, 19, when they're forced to kill and break down doors and murder people because of for no reason, then it's that's a life changing event that doesn't change, that changes you for the rest of your days.
Well, sometimes people come on with horrible post traumatic stress.
They do. I mean,
or terrible feelings of guilt about what they've done.
Millions upon millions of homeless vets are that way because they just, their lives are just so destroyed. And the government refuses to protect them after that. You know, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just lazy.
They're a liability.
You would have been better off than, it's cannon fodder, You should have been stayed out there. So, I mean, that's the attitude they have towards soldiers. And it's like, and they should. No general should have has any real compassion for his soldiers because that general knows that he's gonna make the order for them to get killed, right? So how the hell can a guy have any conscience if he can do that?
They figure there's gonna be a certain amount of collateral damage.
Yeah, but they can look you right in the eye and say, "Go out and kill that guy,"
mm-hmm.
and put your life in harm's way, and they can't have any. They're sociopathic, so it's like to be a general or to be a an officer in the military is like you have to pass all the psychological exams of being a sociopath, So that's what they are. That's why they can kill so many people. That's why they can go into war at a moment's notice and just butcher and maim and destroy and without anything, without any plans. Just go, And it's like, I don't know. Those are the life changing events that happen, and it's so easy to get so clinical when you read. I find you can get so clinical because you're trying to touch on things that here's a nice metaphor, the kaleidoscope.
This is a nice one.
Yeah, it says my parents' kaleidoscope was my early teacher of integration. It wasn't just a cheesy cardboard cylindrical tube with lots of little pieces of torn up tissue paper inside. It also was a kaleidoscope nowadays, but like most kaleidoscopes nowadays, it was a big kaleidoscope with an impressive black leather covered barrel and a tube with a whopping 5 inches or so in circumference. It looked like a telescope, and it had its very own handsome wooden stand. He turned it with 6 notches, brass spokes, reminiscent of a ship captain's wheel, which is I've seen these. The beauty of it is that it had absolutely beautiful things that you could do wonderful things with, And I used to have several kaleidoscopes. And as a kid, I always had. You must have had them. Used to get them all the time.
I always thought they were very fascinating.
Things. Yeah, they're absolutely beautiful things. And now they're my favorite things. And a little bubble in it. She explains this one, and for those of you who might not know what a kaleidoscope is, I don't think many people would.
Oh, everybody knows.
Not everybody.
Sure, they do.
They may not have experienced this.
Sure, they have. Every kid has a kaleidoscope, or every grown up that.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
Well, this fabulous kaleidoscope had many remarkable contents: a tube of glass with liquid that had a little bubble in it, like a carpenter's level, a small square piece of screen, pieces of lace and colored cloth, many colored bits of paper, sequins, one small nail, and what seemed to be a blue doll's eye. I always wondered what the makers of the kaleidoscope would have been thinking when they decided to toss in that eye. It seemed so different, so anthropomorphic, so unlike all the rest of the bits of stuff that were circulated around inside. And because it always seemed so odd, so insistent than everything else, it was always trying to get rid of it, trap it under the wall of the mirror, mirror channel, or magically coax it to the fall through the bottom or so it would stop distorting what I thought was the perfection of all the other pieces and design. And what never ceased to amaze me, though, was that no matter how I held the kaleidoscope, no matter how I might try to prejudice the projection of all the pieces inside it. Tilt it sideways, lift one of the legs of the stand up high, or whatever I did to it. All of the pieces, including, of course, the doll's eye, would always show up in the circle. And when one day I noticed how disinteresting the doll's eye looked, poised as it was for a nanosecond on top of a different square of green of screen, it looked almost beautiful. And in that moment, I accepted it. I noticed in the next turn of the wheel that it looked interesting too, against one of the pieces of lace, and I accepted it more. Finally, I realized that of the course it belonged, that its jarring and sometimes beautifully mysterious humanness added a certain piquancy to the mix, that the kaleidoscope itself and my fascination with it would have never have been what it was without the inescapably weird and beautiful doll's eye. And I can catch that, because certain things that you remember, you know, so well, and certain images that you can remember doing, it's like when I made my book cover, you know, that image on the book cover.
Oh, it's very riveting.
Yeah, and it was that second in time of technical reality that I was able to create this transition in a video, and I was able to grab that second in the still shot and then enlarge it and then and enhance it and take it through an entire digital process through a photo of a video. All right, it was just really bizarre. So it's like three or four different levels of process. Okay, and then taking that color to the extreme contrast, the ultimate contrast that my software could handle, I was able to bring that to the extreme, and it brought out the richest colors and the most interesting textures and it was just incredible. So everything until finally I enhanced it to the extent that I could. That it was a remarkable sight, you know,
mm-hmm.
just the right light and just the right, you know, drama. And I sent it to the publisher. They took it immediately. They loved it. And you know, this is how the book became. And plus, the same thing happened with the picture that I took for the front of the book and designed the back of the book as well. But these are these things that they, you know, you see it and you don't know exactly why it's there, but you know that it's like a link to eternity somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It's an inspiration. It's inspiring you. It's telling you somehow. Just like this woman with the eye and the kaleidoscope. You know,
why did it catch her so much?
Why is it me? Why is it hooking me here? You know. What's it telling me?
And as you
cater to that thought, and you look at what we've talked about on the show before, in the sense of the hierarchy of the in the Agni Yoga series and the Pleiadian experiences and so on, where you can understand then how the hierarchies of the other dimensions, the other levels of evolvement. All right, in fourth, fifth, and sixth dimensional, and seventh dimensional existence actually talk to us, and they talk to us through these unique and incredible tools, or that can create that moment for that one intellect. And I find that when Lila, for instance, when you do counseling, there's a moment when you get to one of the children or the parent or something, and that person clicks, and suddenly a light bulb goes off, and they see an inspiration, and that moment is worth spending the whole day for, because you see it, and it's like, and it's there, and they'll go home, and they'll be happier and healthier people because of that turn of mind,
or you get a spark in your own mind,
or you get a spark in your own mind, right? It comes
that
back at you,
enables,
and you see it.
Enables you to
yeah.
reach out
oh,
to
yeah.
the other person. In the language that they understand, because it's very important to talk to people.
Yeah, and you can stay quiet all day long and then you have one moment of,
and be able to express things in the way that they do,
right,
so that they can understand
them. Yeah, so it's like, you know, in so many ways, there are ways to get out and around. Now, I apologize again, I can't put on this
that's too bad.
Speech, but, well, for some reason, it's not working the way it's supposed to work.
I don't know. You have to take a look at it and see if you can...
Yeah, I wonder if I can fix it and get another one.
Which would be good. I just also wanted to mention, I can't read it because it's too long and my voice isn't good.
Oh, the diet soda one?
Yeah. I
read that last night. I mean, it was pretty insane.
I want people to go to this website, so maybe I'll mention it at the end when you're finished doing it.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish up on this book.
Because I'd like them to go to the website and read it for themselves.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention it. And if you, it's called The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart, and an Emotional and Spiritual Handbook by Daphne Rose Kigma, okay, author of Coming Apart, which is another book.
And she was great.
Yeah, she was very good, and hopefully one day here, we can salvage the interview here and play it again for you one day in the future. But
that would certainly be worthwhile. It was a very good interview.
Yeah, unfortunately. So I'll work on that tomorrow.
Yeah, maybe you could fix that. So
maybe I can even play it tomorrow night. It's kind of a spiritual night, you know.
Oh, that would be a good thing to play.
Yeah. Yeah, people might really enjoy that. So, anyway, and her final words in the final chapter basically were, live simply, and the other thing was go where the love is, which I thought was interesting. In other words, follow
your heart.
Follow your heart, you know, follow your heart and go toward those people who show you the most love, you know.
Or two things that love you. Like that you love, for instance...
Yeah, your children or your pets or your...
Or gardening.
Or
teaching, whatever it is.
Or whatever your passion may be.
And it gives you back 100-fold.
And live in the light of the Spirit. And if you want this crisis to transform you, you will choose to live in the light of the Spirit. And, that's exactly what... basically, Emerson said the same thing. In that you live your... live in the Spirit, you know, and you can't go wrong. Yeah, you know, tragedies are created to create genius, right? And sometimes that needs to happen. Sometimes people have to go along. You know, life is like tarot cards. When you read tarot, they are marking significant events that will take place. In the future or have taken place in the past. And they're milestones, and you have to read those. And that's essentially what that is, when you know...
Well, like the Chinese say, crisis is an opportunity.
Yeah, and they are. So you have to look at that no matter how hard it is, because, boy, I know they sure can come hard.
And when it's happening, sometimes you don't think of it as an opportunity. But,
no, but
maybe after a while you can.
You can.
You can when that fresh hurt... subsides a little bit, and you're able to
but
look at it.
Just know that the fates are there to, you know, smack you around, okay, and to put you on the right course.
I guess we all
right
need
course.
Smacking around.
Yeah, you know, they're there as guideposts to smack you around and get you onto the right track and see if you're made of the right stuff. So.
You better rest your voice a minute.
Yeah. We got about 10 minutes. I have no voice left.
Well, we might end this a little early.
Oh, yeah, we can do that.
We have from Natural News, I just wanted to mention this to you folks. Diet soda is now promoted as medicine to stop kidney stones.
I know. It's ridiculous.
The most retarded science journal of the year award goes to the Journal of Urology, which has published an article suggesting that diet soda is actually an effective type of medicine for preventing kidney stones. The research was led by Dr. Brian Eisner, a urologist at Mass General Hospital in Boston, who is apparently completely clueless about human nutrition and the toxicity of aspartame. According to Dr. Eisner, diet sodas are not only good medicine for preventing kidney stones, they are also a good source of water hydration, noting that patients need to consume 2 to 3 liters of water each day. Dr. Eisner said in a Reuters article, if drinking these sodas help people reach that goal, then that may be a good thing. If you're thinking this is some sort of April Fool's joke, it isn't. Dr. Eisner in the Journal of Urology are somehow convinced that this is good research and that diet sodas may actually have a positive medicinal effect on the human body. Instances of such scientific stupidity appear to be increasing in Western medicine, where doctors remain wildly ignorant of the effects to the human body caused by processed ingredients or toxic chemical additives. Aspartame, used as a primary sweetener in diet sodas, is a potent neurotoxin. According to experts like Dr. Russell Blaylock, many believe it promotes headaches, vision problems, endocrine system problems, and the nervous system disorders. It has never been proven safe for humans' consumption by any honest testing. Most diet sodas also contain alarmingly high levels of phosphoric acid, a substance that causes a huge increase in acidity throughout the body, suppressing immune function, weakening bones, and contributing to kidney stones, not preventing them. There's more about this, and you could get this article. Go to naturalnews.com. Diet sodas are promoted as medicine to stop kidney stones.
Unbelievable insanity. So I think we'll go down.
Yeah, I don't have a...
I want to thank you so much for joining us. We're going to cut out just a little early because we neither of us have any throat. So good night, and thanks for joining us. And
we'll have a good night. And sorry, hopefully our voices come back a little bit.
Yeah. So take care, everyone. Well, maybe. Okay. Oh, good night.